HPPodCraft.com.
When, through the death of a distant relative, I, John Lester, succeeded to the Martindale estate, there could not have been found in the length and breadth of England a happier pair than myself and my only sister, Claire. We were not such utter hypocrites as to affect sorrow for the loss of our kinsman, Paul Lester, a man whom we had never seen, of whom we had heard but little, and that little unfavourable, at whose hands we had never received a single benefit, who was, in short, as great a stranger to us as the then Prime Minister, the Emperor of Russia, or any other human being utterly removed from our extremely humble sphere of life. His loss was very certainly our gain. His death represented to us not a dreary parting from one long loved and highly honoured, but the accession of lands, houses, consideration, wealth to myself, John Lester, artist and second floor lodger at 32 Great Smith Street, Bloomsbury.
Now that is the intro to A Strange Christmas Game by Charlotte Riddell, one of two stories we're covering here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're talking ghost stories at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
This is the last episode of Ghoul Time.
Whee!
Ghoul Time.
Whee!
It's a spooky time of the year.
The spirit world is very close to us, that's true.
Next year, we're finally going to get our flying cars and our replicants, because it's going to be 2019.
Yes, finally. That's right, that's when Blade Runner is set, huh?
Yeah.
I don't really look for future trends in my science fiction. If I do kind of want to know what's going to maybe happen in the future, the book that I lean on the most is the 1968 book Criswell Predicts, written by Criswell, star of Plan 9 from Outer Space, also Orgy of the Dead, among many other great films.
Yeah, of course.
In that book, he writes, this was interesting, on page 105 of that book, he writes about Rhode Island, which is the home of H.P. Lovecraft, as we all know.
Uh-huh.
He writes, "I predict that Rhode Island will be the center of a new movement of the youth of the nation that will make the hippie movement look normal. The next movement will be Youth's Rebellion through nudism. And this movement will begin in Rhode Island and spread throughout the land." So that's...
Wow.
That's a prediction from that book. He's not specific about the year that'll happen, but I've got a good feeling it might be 2019.
I think you're right.
I'll be looking for you folks in Rhode Island.
Also, one very kind of cool thing that's going to be happening in 2019, it's going to be the 10th anniversary of our show.
I know. It's so crazy.
10 years.
Who could have guessed that a podcast about fictional murders could have made it this far? We're probably going to plan some kind of celebratory event in order to mark the occasion of our 10th anniversary. It'll happen in the summer. Also in the summer, there will be the Necronomicon.
Yes.
In Providence. So it's possible we may plan some kind of event for that. Wait a minute. Providence is in Rhode Island.
All right.
Who was that reader we just heard?
Oh my God, you have to ask. That is the megalithic John Hancock.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
Megalithic. I like it.
He's amazing. He always does such good work, and yeah, it's a pleasure to have him on the show. So this week, to round out Ghoul Tide, you're not going to just get one. You're going to get two spooky holiday stories. First, A Strange Christmas Game by Charlotte Riddell. And the second, Smee by A.M. Burridge.
I like it.
Before we get into A Strange Christmas Game, I wanted to do some bio on Charlotte Riddell.
She also wrote under the name J.H. Riddell,
mm-hmm,
or Mrs. J.H. Riddell, because I believe those were her husband's initials. But I think if she wanted to mask her gender, that was the
right
nom de plume that she used. So that's who we're talking about. If folks have heard of J.H. Riddell as well, that is Charlotte Riddell.
So she was born in 1832 in Ireland. She was very influential as a writer in the Victorian period. She wrote 56 books, novels, and short stories, and was part-time owner and editor of St. James Magazine. St. James Magazine was a well-respected lit journal from the 1860s. She died in 1908 at the age of 73. This story was published in 1863.
Let's jump into it.
As we heard at the top, this guy, John Lester, and his sister Claire, they have inherited a manor house from an uncle that died, but they didn't really know him at all. They just are in the family, so they get this house.
They'd heard very little about him, and what they did here wasn't good. And he'd never been generous to them before, or particularly shown any acknowledgement of them either. They're just distant relatives. It's likely that it legally passed to them, and it wasn't necessarily willed to them, which we'll find out more about later.
Right.
It's a big deal, though, because John Lester is a working artist and a second-floor lodger, a position I understand exactly. And I could do with inheriting an estate myself, or maybe not. We'll have to see. Maybe that's not a great thing.
The state is called Martingdale. It's in Bedfordshire.
Over time, the Lesters had been really imprudent and sold off manors and farms sort of willy-nilly from the estate until Martingdale. It's a pretty small place, actually. It's described as a mere little dot in the map of Bedfordshire. The last resident owner was a man named Jeremy Lester.
Jeremy Lester was last seen on Christmas Eve many years ago. It's a bit of a mystery what happened to him. The last guy to see him was his friend, Mr. Worley, who he played cards with that night on Christmas Eve. And then Mr. Worley left, walked home just after midnight. Jeremy Lester was never seen again.
And I think Jeremy was a little bit of a wild man. It says his ways of life had not been either the most regular or the most respectable.
Oh.
So it wasn't until the new year had come in without any tidings of his whereabouts that his servants became seriously alarmed concerning his absence. So he had been gone for a while before anybody even knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Rewards were offered, advertisements were put out, but still nobody could ever find him.
So the house was taken over by Paul Lester and his family, but they left it only after a few months. Rumors got around that the place was haunted. 41 years after the disappearance of Jeremy Lester, Claire and John are going to move in. John is, like you said, an artist, not very well off, so this inheritance is a huge deal. It's life-changing. He and Claire are very close, and she supported him through all of his being poor artist guy. And they've lived together for, I guess, some time, it seems to be. They moved to this new manor house in the summertime.
They don't ever specify what kind of an artist he is, right?
No.
So I guess we're just left to assume interpretive dancer?
Yeah, mime is what I was thinking.
Yeah, probably mime. That's probably what it is.
There's a caretaker and his wife that live at the estate. They have heard the stories about stamping and swearing and knocking of furniture about. Maybe it's the spirit of Mr. Jeremy kicking around.
He had been seen, it was averred, by poachers, by gamekeepers, by children who had come to use the park as a near cut to school, by lovers who kept their tryst under the elms and beeches. So quite a few different types of people have seen this ghost.
There's a oak parlor that folks say seems to be the focus of the haunting, but the caretaker, he stays away from that place.
Right. There's also a red bedroom that the caretaker's wife says she won't enter, not after dark.
The house needs some work because it's a bit run down. People haven't been living there properly for a long time. And John is hesitant to put any money into it as he's not sure where his actual income will be coming from.
Yeah, with all the bad land deals of the past, he doesn't exactly know how much he'll be able to spend. I mean, what is the yearly revenue this place is going to generate? And poverty has taught him to be prudent.
Not sure what to do with the house exactly. John and Claire decide to have a little trip to Paris while the weather is nice. While there, they meet this family, the Cronsons, who have property very close to Martingdale. There was this young lady, Cronson, that John kind of fancies a bit, but Claire likes this little girl back in England, and she thinks that this girl will make a better wife for him and doesn't like the cut of this Cronson lady's jib. Because also this little girl, that's what they refer to her as, which is kind of creepy to me.
But I don't think she's an actual little girl.
No, I think she might be a petite woman. This little girl liked him when he was poor. And she thinks Cronson just likes him because he is now the owner of the estate.
Right.
Because of some family illness, the Cronsons have to take leave early and take off from Paris.
And the narrator, John, says, "All this I can see plainly enough now, but I was blind then." So I think in the rush of getting this property, he was also sort of being easily seduced by this Cronson lady.
So by November, they go to Martingdale. The weather's crappy. It's cold and damp. The Cronsons are not around, but they're in New Norfolk attending to the recovery of Mrs. Cronson.
Right, which is a grandmother. That's why they had to rush home from France. Now that they're back at Martingdale and the weather's so crappy and it's cold and they're really settling into this place, it says the ghost stories we had laughed at became less unreal. It says they became more real also when servant after servant left us to seek situations elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Servants, you should pay attention to what they're doing because they're usually in the know on this stuff. They
yes.
keep leaving the house.
And so over the next few weeks, noises grow more frequent and louder. The caretaker and his wife, they live on the far end of the house. They don't hear anything ever. But there's this tramp, tramp, bang, bang that's going on all night. Some swearing. That would be really terrifying if I just heard some people swearing and I couldn't, you know, like angry, aggressive fighting.
Yeah.
And you couldn't figure out where it was coming from. Real life people doing that freaks me out.
I was going to say it would make me feel like I was back in my childhood home.
Oh, no.
I'd be like, so nice.
God. So John says here, "My dear reader, you doubtless are free from superstitious fancies. You poo-poo the existence of ghosts and only wish you could find a haunted house in which to spend a night, which is all very brave and praiseworthy, but wait till you are left in a dreary, desolate old country mansion filled with the most unaccountable sounds." And I gotta say, I've been that guy. I'm going, you know what? Give me a haunted house. Any day of the week, I'll stay there.
Well, he still didn't put me off by saying that. He says, wait till you're left in a dreary, desolate old country mansion. Sounds great. Let's go.
Let's do it.
I'm ready for it. You didn't talk me out of it.
No.
Even after reading this whole story, you didn't talk me out of it.
No. So Claire and John believe that the place is supernaturally haunted, but they can't afford to move, so they try and see if they can make it work. If not, they're going to have to pull down the right wing of the house.
Yeah, they're going to actually destroy part of the house to solve it, which is always a good way to solve these things. But also, if the haunting is just some banging around here and there, even if with the swearing, I think I could make that work for me if I got to have the whole house, because I've been living in apartments for a couple of decades. I'm used to hearing other people swear and bang around. So
They
don't seem to be threatening anybody.
They're not actually doing anything to anybody else. They seem to have their own business that they're trying to sort out. So John figures that on Christmas Eve, they will have the most luck seeing if the ghost of Jeremy is really what the issue is, because it, of course, is the anniversary of his disappearance.
John says, I determined on Christmas Eve, the anniversary of the disappearance, to keep watch myself in the red bedchamber. Even to Claire, I never mentioned my intention.
It's a quiet night, and by 10, they decide to go to bed since nothing seems to be going on. John goes to this red room, and Claire goes to hers.
He pretends he's going to his room, but then he sneaks over to the red room because he doesn't want her to know that he's doing this.
Exactly.
Folks who've been watching The Haunting of Hill House will know that entering the red room in a haunted house is a mistake. Pretty soon, the moon comes up to illuminate the room, but nothing is happening.
Yeah, he lays there for a while, and almost as he goes to sleep, his sister comes in and tells him to come downstairs. So he gets up, and they go down and peek into the oak parlor.
There was the room we left in darkness overnight, with a bright wood fire blazing on the hearth, candles on the chimneypiece, the small table pulled out from its accustomed corner, and two men seated beside it, playing at cribbage. We could see the face of the younger player. It was that of a man about 25, of a man who had lived hard and wickedly, who had wasted his substance and his health, who had been, while in the flesh, Jeremy Lester.
This isn't even M.R. James stuff.
No.
This is full-on Disney Haunted Mansion.
Yeah.
Where there are actual spectral forms you can see.
That look real.
Right.
So this is like a historical reenactment that's going on.
That's what's...
So somehow John just knows that this is Jeremy. The two men are dressed in period clothes. They have powdered wigs and all that stuff. Jeremy also has some serious bling with these rings and some kind of diamond pin, as well as diamonds on his shoe buckles.
Mm-hmm.
So John and Claire just watch them for a while as they quietly play cards. Finally, the other player, whose face they can't really see, says, I win, the game is mine. And Jeremy looks at the cards and he calls him a cheat and a liar, and he throws the cards in this guy's face. So the two men get all into each other's faces, and then they start knocking over some furniture. Finally, Jeremy leaves the room, stomps upstairs, and comes back down with two rapiers.
Mm-hmm.
He has the other man choose which sword that he wants to fight with, and then they leave. So Claire and John decide to follow them and see where they're going. They go outside, and Jeremy draws a line in the ground, and he says, when you say three, that is when the duel begins. So the other guy goes one, two, and then he just stabs Jeremy in the chest, killing it. When Claire sees this brutal cheating murder, she screams, and the moon is obscured by the clouds, and the two men just disappear.
I guess that's why you always need to have seconds at a duel. Somebody else there to, to catch you doing that kind of thing. Otherwise, why wouldn't you cheat if the other person's going to murder you?
Yeah.
I would cheat every time if nobody was there to witness it. Also, I'm glad that there aren't duels anymore in general.
Yeah.
That's a good thing, I think.
It's a bad idea.
It's pretty shocking how long it hasn't been that long since that was something that people would do.
Yeah.
It's totally insane.
Doesn't make any sense and doesn't prove a thing.
Mm-mm. No.
They found out that Jeremy was betrayed and murdered. They have a quiet night, and in the morning, there's a ton of snow, just like it was the Christmas after Jeremy disappeared. So they go to church, even in the snow, and Claire tells the vicar what happened to them last night.
Mm-hmm.
The vicar doesn't say much about this, but 2 weeks later, when the snow melts, the vicar investigates, and they find a body with diamonds and everything, and they know it's Jeremy's body. The official over the area is Mr. Cronson. So we're back. We got the Cronsons back again. He asks, well, did you see the face of the killer? To which they say, no, not really. They couldn't get a good look at him. So Cronson just shrugs and says, well, there's nothing I could do.
Right.
This is a murder that happened 41 years ago. A few days later, when they're having dinner over at the Cronson place, Claire drops her glass and she screams. She points at a portrait and says, that is the face of the man who stabbed Jeremy. Mrs. Cronson, she freaks out and everything goes all nutty. Claire wants to be taken away, not just from this house, but from Martindale as well.
Before we left the latter place, however, I had an interview with Mr. Cronson, who said the portrait Claire had identified was that of his wife's father, the last person who saw Jeremy Lester alive. He is an old man now, finished Mr. Cronson, a man of over 80, who has confessed everything to me. You won't bring further sorrow and disgrace upon us by making this matter public. I promised him I would keep silence, but the story gradually oozed out, and the Cronsons left the country. My sister never returned to Martindale. She married and is living in London. Though I assure her there are no strange noises in my house, she will not visit Bedfordshire, where the little girl she wanted me so long ago to think of seriously is now my wife and the mother of my children.
I'm not going to marry the granddaughter of a dirty cheat, you know, who's stabbed on two instead of three. I'm going to go for the quote-unquote little girl.
Yeah,
I was surprised in that one that there was the actual manifestation, like I said. And seeing that, I would have checked for a projector, like in Scooby-Doo. Because given what they saw, it's like the only circumstance where a projector, you know, these ghosts didn't chase them.
No.
So a projector in this instance, it might have actually worked.
No, Chad, it would not have worked. A film projector projects an image on a wall. It doesn't.
Right.
We had a little film projector, Super 8 film projector. Mm. And believe you me, I tried to make it look like things were in the room and it just projects onto the wall. That's all it does.
Stop talking about it. You're scaring me. Let's move on to the next story. This is too horrifying of a discussion. I love this title, Smee. It's a portmanteau of It's Me.
Right.
And it immediately makes you think of a children's game, which is so great if you can do that in one word in a title.
Mm.
And that is what the story is about. Who is this author, A.M. Burridge?
Alfred McLelland Burridge was a British writer. He was born in 1889. During his life, he was known as a young adult author, mostly for the popular series Tufty. But after his death, he has been more well known for his ghost stories, and that's kind of kept him in literary circles. In 1927, he wrote a book called Some Ghost Stories, of which this story is from.
That is the laziest title I've ever heard, you know. Yeah, it's Some Ghost Stories. I don't know. Read it if you want to.
But M.R. James, he loved this book, saying that it keeps on the right side of the line, and if about half his ghosts are amiable, the rest have their terrors and no mean ones. Burridge died in 1956.
Well, let's get into Smee.
It was Christmas Eve, and we were a party of 14 with just the proper leavening of youth. We had dined well, it was the season for childish games, and we were all in the mood for playing them. All that is, except Jackson. When somebody suggested hide-and-seek, there was rapturous and almost unanimous approval. His was the one dissentient voice. It was not like Jackson to spoil sport or refuse to do as others wanted. Somebody asked him if he were feeling seedy.
And he responded, "Why would you think I'm seedy?" adjusting his large, dark glasses and crossing his bare legs slowly beneath his trench coat. Seedy? I think seedy in this context means like unwell or sick.
Yeah, as you heard, the story begins with this guy, Tony Jackson, refusing to play hide-and-seek at one of these crazy manor parties, which, of course, I don't really understand because nobody I know is that wealthy.
Yeah.
I never went to any parties at manor houses.
No way.
Where people played hide-and-seek. Adults did this because it was so big that you could actually run around and hide in places.
And that you would be able to stay there without really annoying people.
Yeah.
The idea of staying over the Christmas holidays with somebody gives me like a panic attack. But these people were staying in a place where they'd have their own fireplace in their own room. You know,
like,
I don't get it.
Well, anyway, Jackson is usually a good sport about this kind of stuff, but he's not up for hide and seek. He doesn't like the game, and he's got a story as to why.
He says, "I sometimes go and stay at a house where a girl was killed. She was playing hide and seek in the dark. She didn't know the house very well. There was a door that led to the servant's staircase. When she was chased, she thought that door led to a bedroom. She opened the door and jumped and landed at the bottom of the stairs. She broke her neck, of course." Pretty horrific accident that happened in this house he goes to.
Again, it makes me think that it's a kid, but I don't know if it was a kid. I think it was an adult that was playing this game and this happened to.
Yeah, definitely someone young, but in my head I keep thinking it's a little kid. But yeah, you're right. It would probably be somebody like a young adult.
The thing is, Jackson wasn't there when the girl died. He was there during some other disturbing event, and that gets people even more interested. So he asked the party if they ever played a game called Smee. Now, Smee is kind of like hide and seek, but a bit different. So one person is chosen at random, usually with a folded sheet of paper, all empty, but one of them says Smee on it. You randomly get a piece of paper, you open it up. If it says Smee on there, you're going to be it, basically. Yeah. So this all happens in the dark. Smee leaves the room first and goes and hides, and then everybody leaves the room as well, and they all spread out. When you sneak around, and if you find somebody, you say, Smee. If they say, no, not me, then you keep looking around. And when you find somebody and they don't say anything, you know you found Smee, and you just plant yourself right where they are. So eventually everybody ends up getting to this location. The last person who finds Smee is the loser.
Everybody else has to go out in the dark as well, right?
Yeah.
That's the only part I was puzzled about. I think you'd all have to scatter, otherwise it'd be pretty obvious who the...
Oh, right.
You'd all just be looking for one person. The one thing that does sound fun about this game, though, is it must have a kind of climax, because as more people find Smee, their numbers grow. It becomes more obvious. So then it would be like a race to get in the gang. So it's kind of fun because it starts as a hide-and-seek and then ends with the almost musical chairs kind of rush, I think.
Yes.
Pretty cool. And then if you lose, you have to pay a forfeit, which they don't say what that is.
Yeah.
Is there a common forfeit you pay for these kinds of games? Does it mean you pay a sum of money, or you have to give
do
someone
a dance?
Back rub or do a dance? Yeah, I don't know what it is.
I don't know. Yeah, they don't specify it, and I'm not Victorian enough to know.
Right.
So Jackson says he's played Smee at this house where the girl broke her neck, and he says the girl might have been there even after her death. A few years back, there were 13 of them playing Smee in the house that the girl died in.
Which is odd, because there were only 12 of them in attendance at the party. Mm-hmm. So who was the extra player? Obviously, the ghost of the girl. No real suspense here on that count. He kind of summarizes, or he gives you a very good idea of what the story is going to be before he even tells it.
So he doesn't know her name. He just heard about her through gossip. And one person suggests, since he doesn't want to play hide and seek, that he tells them what the story is, what this creepy thing that happened to him. And he agrees. And that gets us into chapter two. The story begins with Jackson in Surrey with his cousins.
He's gone there to spend Christmas with them. Says it was an old house with lots of unnecessary passages and staircases.
At dinner, he's introduced to everyone except for this tall, dark-haired girl. And he says the girl looked cold but clever. He's seated next to Mrs. Gorman, who's very bright and amusing.
But he doesn't get to talk to the clever girl. She's seated kind of far away from him at the table. He was hoping that he'd overhear her name even, but she's in conversation far enough down that he can't.
So he says they were all young, or trying to be young, with the youngest person in the group being 17 years old, and that was this guy Reggie, whose parents were part of the group. Reggie then suggests that they play Smee, which is the first time that Jackson has ever heard of this game. So this is where he learns how to play Smee. Reggie explains the rules and everybody's up for it. This guy, Jack, warns them about the stairs and the door that the girl fell down and died 10 years ago.
The staircase also reminds me of The Haunting of Hill House as well, the novel rather than the television show. Mm. Although obviously they have one in that show, and then also the old Robert Wise, The Haunting movie. Mm-hmm. And that spiral staircase is crucial to the whole plot. I was thinking about this as I was reading how we had some staircases and stairwells in our earlier stories as well.
Oh, right, yeah.
They always really link up with haunted house stories. Obviously, houses that are big are going to have stairways and stairwells, but I'm just saying action plays out on these things a lot.
Yeah.
And I think there are practical reasons, right? Because when somebody's down at the bottom of the stairs, you can't see them. So that's a good place to position a ghost. But I started thinking maybe there are metaphorical reasons for this as well, because people are crossing to that other side.
Oh, right.
The stairwell kind of represents the gateway between the living world.
They're either ascending up to a higher plane of existence or maybe delving down into the underworld.
Yeah, whether intended or not, I think that they play that role in a lot of haunted house stories.
Now, there are 12 of them in total, and they do the fold of paper bit. So there's 11 blank pieces of paper and one that says Smee on it. So they play the game and everyone has fun. Jack is last one, so he has to do the forfeit.
He's got
to
eat a spider.
He lights a match to count to make sure that they're all there, but he counts 13. Then he points this out and folks just say, oh, you've miscounted, or you've counted yourself twice. And the match goes out and he lights it again and he counts 13 again. And he goes, look, I'm sure there's 13 people here.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Cousin, pale white girl with long black hair is moaning from a supernaturally widened mouth. Cousin, that clever girl. Sorry, everybody was rude and we weren't introduced, so I don't know her name. Cousin with the wonky eye. And it goes on like this. You see the joke I made.
Jack's son, Reggie, takes out the electric torch and he counts 12. So Jack just laughs it off like I made a mistake. Jackson overhears this woman, Violet, is talking to someone else, saying that she was sure that there was somebody else sitting by her that wasn't there when the electric torch came on. It was after our narrator heard this that he felt like the whole mood changed. People were still laughing, but it was all kind of off. And then that gets us into chapter three. So the next round, Jackson is Smee. Violet finds him last. Reggie pulls Jackson over and he's pale with worry. He says that he was in the other part of the house and he touched someone's hand. Reggie said Smee and they didn't answer. So he figured, okay, this is the person. But after some time passed, he got kind of a cold, wrong feeling. So he turned on his flashlight. Nobody was there. And he was standing in the doorway. So no one could have gotten out of the room that he was at.
There are some problems with the story, but in general, I think it's such a cool way to tell a ghost story with the ghost infiltrating a game.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a different dynamic than what we usually see.
Yeah.
It lends itself to confusion, obviously, because people are running around in the dark.
Of course, Jackson says, you just imagined you touched somebody's hand. And Reggie goes, oh, yeah, of course.
You can tell he's nervous about it. He gave a short laugh. I knew you would say that, he said. Of course I imagined it. That's the only explanation, isn't it?
So they go off to play another round of Smee, Chapter 4. Now, Jackson has this feeling that no one actually wants to play anymore, but nobody wants to be the party pooper and say, let's not play this game anymore. So something is off about all of this and everyone senses it.
There was some unnatural, unhealthy influence at work in the house, but they just kept playing the game.
So Jackson is searching around and he touches some knees and he says, Smee, but no reply. And he's at a window seat, which is at the end of a very long passage. He touched the arm of a woman, but he can't see her.
Yeah, she's hiding behind the curtains, which go all the way to the floor. So according to the rules of the game, he now has to sit with her in the dark and wait.
So as he's sitting waiting, he asks her her name and she says Brenda Ford. And that gets us into Chapter 5. He doesn't recognize the name, but he figures she must be the tall, dark-haired girl from dinner. The game is about being quiet, but he really wants to chatter up. So he keeps saying things like, are you enjoying the game? Where are you from? Do you like movies about gladiators? But she's not saying anything back to him. So he takes this as she's not interested and he starts to feel uncomfortable.
The feeling of something wrong, something unnatural, was growing. I remember touching her arm and I trembled with horror. I wanted to jump and run away. I prayed that someone else would come along soon.
And just then, Mrs. Gorman shows up. It's totally dark, but she touches him and guesses that he's Jackson. She asks if he's Smee, and he says, no, she's on my other side.
It says she reached out across me. I heard her fingernails scratch a woman's silk dress. So Mrs. Gorman has touched this entity as well.
She says that she's feeling off. She can't get this idea out of her head that there's someone there that's not supposed to be there. Jackson feels the same way, but he doesn't say anything. Mrs. Gorman made him feel better just by being there in general. So he's like, well, you know, I'm not going to escalate things. I'm just going to kind of let it go. They sit there for a long time until Reggie finally shows up and he asks, where have you guys been? Reggie says that he was Smee. And Jackson is like, no, this girl is Smee. And then he turns on his electric light, but it's only Jackson and Mrs. Gorman there.
Dun, dun, dun.
So Jackson starts to feel sick to his stomach, which I thought was kind of cool.
Sure.
We don't get a lot of that in the ghost stories, people feeling nauseous.
No.
Is people faint or they just get real scared or they sweat or, you know, have bad dreams. But like, you know, getting sick to your stomach, I think might be a more common reaction to something like this.
Yeah, I agree.
I thought it was cool. So both Jackson and Mrs. Gorman insist that they touch the woman. And Reggie gives a shaky little laugh and says, somebody's been playing jokes. Chapter 6, the final chapter. They all get back together and Reggie explains where he found them. And Jackson goes up to the dark-haired girl and accuses her of faking it and then sneaking off. Jack Sangston seems kind of ticked at Tony Jackson and he takes him off to the side for a private chat.
Tony, he said, I suppose you were in love with Mrs. Gorman. That's your business, but please don't make love to her in my house during a game. You kept everyone waiting. It was very rude of you, and I'm ashamed of you. But we were not alone, I protested. There was somebody else there. Somebody who was pretending to be Smee. I believe it was that tall, dark girl, Miss Ford. She whispered her name to me. Of course, she refused to admit it afterwards. Jack Sangston stared at me. Miss who? He breathed. Brenda Ford, she said. Jack put a hand on my shoulder. Look here, Tony, he said. I don't mind a joke, but enough is enough. We don't want to worry the ladies. Brenda Ford is the name of the girl who broke her neck on the stairs. She was playing hide-and-seek here 10 years ago.
That's the end of the story.
That is the end. And obviously we knew that that was what was going on. It's pretty telegraphed.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, should you do the backstory before or after you tell the ghost story, if a backstory is required? Which it often is in a ghost story.
Yeah.
I was about to dog this for telling the whole story of the girl who died at the beginning, but at the same time, I don't know if I have a better solution for that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe if we start in the middle of the game and then you learn it as you go somehow, I'm not sure, but
I don't mind it. It's sort of like you're privy to what's going on and the characters in the story aren't. So you feel a little suspense on their behalf.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this story. I thought it was really fun read and it was creepy. Even though nothing bad happens to anybody, that's sort of that idea of when you're doing something fun and having a good time, that something subverts that.
Right.
Like supernatural even coming in and twisting that into something horrible.
I guess, and I enjoyed the story as well, but I guess what I'm saying is maybe it's a little clumsy to have this. He goes, I walked in and there was a girl I didn't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the dark, he thinks, oh, it must be just that girl. I just, would it be a more effective story is if he had the experience in the dark and then he turns on the lights and he says, I swear to God, there was somebody sitting with me. And then the guy who knows says, well, that's odd, but I should tell you, a girl did die in this room while playing hide and seek. And then it's like that kind of, oh, crap. It really might have been somebody rather than he already knows that happened.
Yeah.
But then he still assumes that it's, I don't know, it seemed a little odd.
Well, maybe having the setup in the beginning, what that does for the reader is that puts you ready for ghosty things. And if you don't that there's going to be ghosty things, that when you're reading the story, you might not get creeped out by it because you're not ready for ghosty things.
Well, one thing I thought would be a payoff is if somebody tells me, hey, a girl died in this house, so you know, be careful of that room, I'd go, oh, they're setting up a joke. So when in the dark we go to play this hide and seek, I would expect that they would try and scare me.
Oh, right, yes.
Because they set it up with the story. So I would expect that that was coming, and I thought that was maybe they were going to play on that a little
bit.
Where the characters were in disbelief, like, yeah, I'm sure that you guys put us up to this. But there really wasn't a lot of that either, so I don't know. In general, though, I did like the story. I definitely love the title, and I love the mechanism of having this, this game.
You know, what's been really cool about Ghoultide is remembering that this time of year, even though it's full of merriment and mirth and joy and hope and all those really nice things, there's a reason why we focus on that, is because this is the darkest time of the year.
Yeah.
The longest nights.
Mm-hmm.
It gets really cold in a lot of countries where people can die from freezing to death. You know, the elements are at their worst. So it's, historically speaking, a very dark, horrible time of year.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole reason why we have these winter festivals, these solstices, kind of like get us through it.
Try to distract you from it, because it does remain. I mean, it's a hard time of year for folks for a number of reasons, even still, despite all the festivities. And there's that drawing in closer with your family and friends, and that might make you remember that you don't have many family and friends, or that you've lost them. And so we're kind of in that mode of reminiscing about people who died.
Yeah.
Maybe anyway, when we're, and so, yeah, it's very natural to have ghost stories around this time of year.
I'm definitely glad that we did Ghoultide this year, and I'm hoping maybe we can do it again next year as well.
In the new year, we're going to be bringing you some new fears.
Whoa!
Which is a very lame way for me to say it's going to be a potpourri of stories in January.
Right.
But they all will be horror stories based on some odd things maybe we haven't covered before. The first one is mist-related. I think it's a really, really great story. We're kicking it off. It's a classic that's been requested multiple times. It's a story called The Night Wire by H.F. Arnold.
All right.
It's a good one. For this episode, I want to thank all our readers for the month, but particularly in this episode, I want to thank John Hancock for giving us a solid reading.
John Hancock, it's so good to hear your voice, and it's great to have you closing out 2018.
And I also want to thank some of our patrons who are partners in this experience and whom I hope have had a very good holiday season. I'm going to start by thanking Aaron Saliba.
And I want to thank Levi Williams.
Miko Repka.
Johannes Peterson.
Sean Scheidler.
Roby Duncan.
Rachel Anna Brown.
I want to thank Daniel Wiley.
Gavin Hughes, thank you.
And Glenn Benedict, thank you so much.
Well, that's all we got for Ghoultide, folks. Hope you have a wonderful New Year's Eve, and we'll be back in January with some new fears. With that, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
HPPodcraft.com.